Hi, this is Paul Tepper from WorkFusion. I'm the head of AI, and this is what happens when machine meets world.
Live from Infinia ML, this is Machine Meets World. And now, here's your host, James Kotecki.
Hey, we are live. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. And thank you so much for joining us today, Paul. We're super excited to chat with you about AI. You have a great title, Head of AI, very futuristic, very cool title. And we're so glad that you're here today. I think it's important to start with some context about kind of where you've come from. You have 20 years of experience in AI. WorkFusion is in a space known as RPA, robotic process automation, not always known for cutting edge AI. What kind of drew you to this opportunity?
There's kind of like the very simple explanation of I was working at a financial services firm, was at Morgan Stanley at the time, and I was looking for work and looking for a change. I wanted to get back into the tech world. And I think startups are generally the most exciting places to work, you know. WorkFusion was a nice place to look at because it's late stage. They've got a good amount of funding on their hands. But I think what the real answer there you're looking for is kind of like how exciting what we're doing is really. We've got a lot of really interesting and exciting problems that we're working on here at WorkFusion. In particular, things like trying to let our customers benefit from the network effects of being part of WorkFusion and being part of being one of our customers. We're looking at things like federated learning, differential privacy. I know these are big words I can get into later if you want to,
yeah.
But it's all very cutting edge stuff and it's pretty exciting. I would say that like enterprise automation and RPA in general, although it sounds a bit dry, it's a very good business to be in right now. I think Gartner estimates the space at like 2 billion right now for 2021, and it's growing by double digits. And I think we're really differentiated in the space because the company was really started with an ML and NLP core. So it's not so much about like, you know, sitting at a desktop and recording the actions that you're doing, which a lot of RPA is about, where you're maybe replacing one or two FTEs or people worth of work. We're looking at things where it's kind of like, you're starting with ML at the core and then you're kind of building kind of automation around it. And we've got a lot of really smart, really interesting people working here. So there's a lot of good reasons.
I know that WorkFusion talks a lot about intelligent automation as a concept. And so maybe an on-ramp into some of these other concepts that you're mentioning is just what does it mean for automation to actually be intelligent? What do the end users, the companies that you work with, notice about what you're able to do because you're able to make something intelligent out of automation?
Yeah, I think this one can be one of those rabbit hole kind of questions. Whenever you talk about what does it mean to be intelligent or AI, you know, you can probably go on Twitter and find a bunch of people arguing about AGI or artificial general intelligence. You know, people like Elon Musk, they like to talk about a lot of this stuff a lot. So I try to like steer away from that kind of philosophical side of things and get down to like the nuts and bolts of what it actually means. I had a professor back like those 20, I've been doing this 20 years when I first started doing this stuff. I think he used to say that AI is not about making computers intelligent as much as it is about making them less dumb. When you think about it, like a lot of the things we do every way, these simple like rules and algorithms, those in and of itself are not particularly smart. And even the best AI today, I mean, it doesn't even compare to like a one-year-old in terms of its ability to learn and its intelligence. So for me, making automation intelligent really makes it, you know, more flexible. So you're not just talking about rules, you're using machine learning, which allows you to be more flexible because you're looking at kind of statistical models as opposed to just a bunch of rules stacked on top of each other. And I think, you know, when it comes to what we do specifically, deploying this kind of ML at scale, you can go back like to like this 2014, 2015 Google paper that was about the hidden technical debt of machine learning. Like it's one thing to have a data scientist or an AI scientist build a model that can do some kind of a prediction. We're quite good at doing those kinds of things now, but to actually deploy that at scale, connect it to all the different systems you would need in an enterprise to actually make it something useful. that's, I think that's where we come in. You know, we can really simplify that process, and that we've really thought about that full end-to-end pipeline and making it easier, do all the integrations and take all the steps. So a model with maybe one node in that kind of graph of a workflow or of an automation. And I think that's, yeah, that's where we come in.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, the artificial intelligence part of this is just a smaller piece of what needs to be a system that works for a lot of human intelligences coming in and playing a role in many different pieces of the puzzle, right? That you're putting this all together and actually resulting in something that's useful to people. So another way to kind of ground this conversation and to orient people into Work Fusion specifically is how does this actually get applied? Can you just big picture, just kind of talk about some of the most promising use cases that you guys are working on?
Yeah, sure. So these days, our major focus areas are in financial services, insurance, healthcare. We do a lot of other verticals as well, kind of smaller scale things there. And I think when it comes to financial services, a lot of the automation tends to do with things like regulations. So you'll hear the financial services talk a lot about like the burden, you know, the regulations. Mm-hmm. When in fact, I think, you know, the more, you know, positive way to spin it is we're a lot of people have put a lot of time and effort into building regulations to making it safe for people to do things with their money, you know, so that they're not getting defrauded and not having, you know, bad things happen to them with their money. So those regulations introduce a lot of work, though, that has to get done. So today, these financial services firms in particular, you'll often have like dozens of people, whole departments devoted to dealing with this kind of regulation. So to get a little more specific, you know, things like anti-money laundering, keeping track of who the different people are in a chain of a payment. We'll often call that payment sanction screening. You know, you'll look at a different payment, a payment, and see if a person or an entity or a country is on a watch list. Names, different people's names are on these kind of monitored lists. So that's kind of one of the big use cases that we look at is, today, the way that's done is a person has to go through and check that name against some list. And there are technologies that are involved there, but still ends up requiring a lot of manual review. But machine learning and NLP, those technologies have gotten to the point now where you can do a lot of that stuff highly in a highly accurate way, you know, cover 80, 90% of that work. So I think a lot of the use cases are around things like that, where we're helping to deal with the kind of work that's involved in satisfying these regulations, anything from, like I said, these name sanctions to tracking email communications, updating systems of record. In the insurance spaces, you know, you could probably imagine the amount of work that that has to be dealt with when you are dealing with claims processing, calculating benefits, just a lot of different people doing a lot of different work. And a lot of that work just ends up kind of being like copying and pasting one thing from another system to another system, looking at two different similarly spelled things and seeing if they match. So those are kind of a lot of the big use cases.
And this is where it gets back to those network effects that you talked about earlier on in our conversation. Because what's interesting here is that you're dealing with a lot of highly regulated industries with highly sensitive data, but you're dealing with processes that, if not fully standardized, at least have some elements of standardization within them. All these companies have to be doing similar kinds of things with similar kinds of data to meet regulatory and legal requirements. So if you were just look at this from a straight AI data science perspective, you'd think, great, let's pool everybody's resources. Let's pool all that data together and train a system that's trained on everybody's data so it can be as powerful as possible. But of course, you're in these industries that are highly siloed and highly cautious for very good reasons. So how do you figure out how to balance these two competing priorities?
So I would say there's kind of like two or three parts to this. We can solve the problem in different ways. Like one way is technology. I think that's generally where I'm focused on. And it's kind of where I start. That stuff I was talking about earlier, where I was pretty excited about that requires a little more unpacking. So one of the things you're seeing now and we're trying to early apply is federated learning. Federated learning is where you'll have a variety of different customers or people training models. And then you can take those models and combine them, like in the cloud, for example, or in some separate site. Now, the way you get around or you get away from kind of the way you can abstract away and deal with privacy concerns there is instead of taking the actual training data now, you're just kind of taking the parameters of the models, or we call those weights. You know, so you can kind of take the weights and you can combine the models that way. And federated learning is a big area I think you're, sorry. you're seeing it used today on a lot of places, like you'll see it in edge computing, mobile devices, maybe models for doing things like face recognition or predictive text and text messaging, where you have like millions of devices doing little models and bringing them up to the cloud and unifying them. And I think it's very, very cutting edge, and not many people are doing it now, to actually say, no, we've got actually five different banks and we're going to combine models from them into a model that's actually better at, you know, background checks, or what we call know your customer. That's one thing we're doing, where to allow you to kind of get away from that training data, but you still have this potential problem of like, what if you can reverse engineer the weights back to the data? This is like a common thing people are worried about now. So you can add another layer of protection there called differential privacy. Differential privacy is where you add noise to a model, or you add noise to training data. And there's a whole bunch of math that's been worked out around like this trade-off between the amount of noise you add and how that obfuscates the data, or makes it so that you can't trace back any individual data point to an individual person. It's a trade-off, because it actually, when you add noise to your training data, it makes the model less accurate, right? So that's one big thing that we're doing now. So we have differential privacy, and we've got federated learning. Those are like technology solutions, but of course there's also like the business side of it. I think business norms are changing, just as we're having a lot of like this kind of cloud transformation stuff happening right now. There's also AI transformation that's happening. And I think companies are becoming more and more comfortable with, if you put in these protections and you can come up with kind of a legal framework or legal description for describing what you're doing, we're going to, you know, move forward with trying these things out. And of course, just the legal frameworks that are in place. We have, you know, good counsel who can help us ensure that everybody's comfortable with this sort of thing, and it's all kind of opt-in. These techniques are, I think, widely recognized at this point as being safe, and it's more just a matter of porting them to these new use cases, and then also kind of, you know, getting everybody on board that, you know, understanding how they work.
You know, it's so interesting, because we've got as this model in of economic competition, right, between companies, between banks. Everybody kind of understands that on an intuitive level, that the way we grow as an economy is, you know, through competition. And yet with AI specifically, it's a place where the more data that you can collect, the more that you can share these kind of resources at a safe, generalized, anonymized, privatized level, the more it can actually benefit everyone in the industry. So our businesses, our regulators actually needing to take not a completely different view, but maybe just a slightly different view on economics 101 and kind of competition and how they are in relationship to what are usually their competitors, because it actually benefits everybody if you can get an AI, for example, that automates out a drudgerous task that nobody in any company wants to do.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's kind of it's not an easy question, but I think it's not really a new question either. Like, I think the problems in around protecting, how do we protect people's privacy while at the same time not stifle innovation? They're like classic problems for any kind of regulation. And even for AI, I don't think these are necessarily new problems. You've already got, I think the EU and Europe are a little bit farther along in terms of actually instituting these kind of regulations. You've got like GDPR and other kinds of regulations now. You know, now you've got that like cookie pop up on every website you go to that says, do you consent to having these cookies? And it's kind of the same problem. I feel like it's being more focused on these days, and through the lens of like big tech with ad supported businesses, you know, there it's like you're the product. So it's kind of this outgrowth of this model of like selling eyeballs, but now with hyper targeting and everything, there's just a lot more concern about the privacy. I think, you know, it's a balance. Like, regulators have to adapt and evolve to this new technology while not stifling innovation and allowing companies to continue to make life easier. It's just, there's just these different applications, and I feel like the cost benefit or like the risks associated with them are different based on the problem. It's one thing if like a company's trying to like sell you something, you know, by targeting you with ads. It's another thing if the company's saying like, well, we can actually provide you with better retirement planning if we actually know, you know, what life events you have going on, that sort of thing. So right. In general, I feel like in general, I feel like the regulations, at least in the United States, are a bit behind. You know, we should be trying things and experimenting and doing more right now. But I do think there's a balance that can be struck here.
When an individual business leader looks at issues of regulation and societal policy, there's only so much that they can do to actually influence that themselves. Mm-hmm. But what they do have a lot of control over is how they look at what's happening now in relationship to AI, automation, intelligent automation, and how that can change the way that they view their own core business, their fundamental mm-hmm. business. And this is something that I know you're passionate about, which is how do these technologies, once you can automate and intelligently automate things that you could never before, how does that create in business leaders a new sense of what their business actually is or should be?
Right. I mean, I would frame it more as like not so much rethinking what their business should be, but hopefully allowing them to focus on it more so they can kind of free up all their resources to do things that are really more focused on what they actually do. So, you know, I just came from a place where recently I was at Morgan Stanley where we had a team of PhDs that were hired up to build conversational automation. That was what I was working on before I was at WorkFusion. And to me, this like that in and of itself kind of seems like, you know, a bit of a distraction from the job of providing the best financial services to a customer, right? Like having to actually hire up your own AI teams. I think really like, it makes sense to kind of concentrate these businesses, these AI businesses kind of as separate things, you know, work with a company like WorkFusion, work with another vendor who's really custom and specialized in that area. So that way you can kind of be freed up to say, mm-hmm. have all these people who have really strong backgrounds in financial services thinking about financial services problems and how we provide the best financial products to our customers, as opposed to having to focus on this kind of more menial tasks and more manual labor that can be automated.
And if you just generalize that concept to build versus buy, I mean, obviously you're biased, I'm biased as well.
Yes.
but this seems like something that you're really passionate about. Do you mm-hmm. think, what are some of the reasons? It sounds like you're saying you should pretty much always buy, or increasingly you're going to be able to just buy this from other companies and you should focus your business on what your core business is best at. What are the circumstances, maybe? What are the edge cases in which people should still think about building their own in-house forms of data science, intelligent automation, hiring their own data scientists, et cetera?
So when you end up, I think you have to kind of look at what you have to build. So if what you have to build requires you to build a lot of things, a lot of new things, say knowledge resources or knowledge graphs or business processes or whatever, and building them with your own tools or your own people, is the same or less work than building it inside of some product. That's where you kind of have to go more towards maybe you want to build something as opposed to buy it. And I think you'll see these kind of, you know, Gartner, they have these like hype cycles, you know, where the technology starts to evolve. And you'll often see, I think, early on in these stages when people are trying to figure out what technologies they want to adopt, that the vendor landscape for these things tends to be kind of immature. So you may want to start by doing experiments and seeing what kinds of things you can build yourself. And then just be flexible enough and don't like, invest so much in this thing that in 2 or 3 years, when the market realizes that, you know, there's lots of companies to be built here, lots of businesses to be built here, and it actually could be built as kind of a self-contained product, that you haven't built so much internally that you can't necessarily port it over to a company. Because that's kind of the loop that you see over and over again is like, we built all this stuff and now we can't port it, but the cost of maintenance is so high. We have to have this team of people that doesn't really make sense for our business to continue to maintain. I've seen that cycle kind of over and over again through the years. And I feel like that's kind of the idea of it. And I think software methodologies like agile and really hewing to those kind of ways of doing things where you're doing kind of small proofs of concept and being nimble and agile, those things really help you to stay in that mindset of experimentation and keeping things small and POCs, as opposed to building like giant applications that really in a few years, you know, there's going to be a company that's going to come along to help you do it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's an interesting conundrum for business leaders, right? It's like, I need this thing now. It doesn't exist in the market mm-hmm. now in a place that I can buy it. So I can either build it in-house and hope that I can port it over in a couple of years, or in a couple of years, maybe I would have wished that I had just waited a couple of years, done nothing, and then just bought it off the shelf because it was already there, ready made, and now it's more maintainable.
Yeah, and that's definitely the conundrum. it's a, again, it's one of these trade-off situations. It's a bit hard to really make that call where how much should you invest in the near term before this thing exists, you know, so, as a vendor product.
Yeah. So for business leaders watching this, maybe help them understand what's coming in the next couple of years. Like what are some of the things, what are the cutting edge things that you're on the cusp of doing or kind of expect to happen in the relatively near future that maybe you can't quite do now, or most business leaders don't realize are going to be automatable very soon?
So I guess I'm not, oops, my headphones popped out. I'm not, not the best at predicting the future myself. But I would say in general, there's two sides of this. One is that given the existing technology, I think most companies are really just scratching the surface with what they can do. So it's not so much a matter of like how many new things are coming down the pike, but like already today with the stuff that we've already got, what can we do? And I really feel like we're just scratching the surface. I'm not going to lie, like setting up these systems and building them takes a lot of work. A lot of my past was in conversational AI, and now I'm working in more like document processing and back office processing with WorkFusion. And I would say like ultimately it's pretty similar what you have to do in either cases. Automation is kind of automation. And a lot of what it comes down to is you have all these people doing this job that's close to be, that's potentially possible to automate, but you've got to get that information out of their heads and into the system, whether it's, you know, an automation for a legal process or a regulatory process or a conversational process. Ultimately, someone's doing this job today, and you've got to map this flow of things that they do into this system. And it takes time. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of integrations, a lot of software that has to be built. So I feel like, you know, we're, the big things that I'm excited about is just cutting down the time to value and making it easier to do that through great user experiences, through great software design, and through AI and modeling as well. You know, down the road, I do see like in the AI world, a lot of the modeling is getting better. So you're going to start to see things like today, most of the models do one of two things. They either classify, which means they bucket documents or whatever it is, language into these different buckets, or they extract, like pull out names and places and people from things. And the realm of like summarization and making logical conclusions or entailment from one thing to another, that's still in the research world for the most part. There's a few companies that are trying to do things, but it's not like classification and extraction where everybody really is taking advantage of this technology. So I would say like down the line, I would think that we'll start to see more applications that involve summarization and involve understanding of like large documents beyond just extracting information from them. But I wouldn't quote me on that as to when it's actually going to be the case, because you know, already today it takes a fair amount of work to demonstrate that your model is doing what you say it is, you know, the evaluation side of things. So it'll be even harder when it starts to get into the realm of like, oh, can this thing pass an SAT exam, you know, and how do you know it's actually doing that, you know?
Well, this is useful, I think, to think about, because it's not just for the business leaders to sit around and wait for the technology to get invented and then decide what to do with it. If, as you're saying, and as I agree, we're aiming in this direction of additional insights, additional understanding, it's to the business leaders and the subject matter experts to begin thinking now about the kind of Absolutely. Applications that they could do if this technology existed, and start aiming their company in that direction, start doing data preparation and data collection with those kinds of things in mind, et cetera. And ultimately, those, I would assume you agree, would be the people that are actually going to be leaders in this new space when that technology exists. They're ready to jump on it rather than take a bunch of time to evaluate what's possible.
Absolutely. And I think if you wanted to borrow from kind of that Silicon Valley mindset and bring it into other industries, other verticals, it's that idea of building out frameworks for experimentation. And you'll see, like, if you look and you read the kind of the AI blogs from the various companies out there that are making waves in this area, you know, Facebook or Uber, you'll see they all have platforms that allow them to easily package up a model and then do some kind of an A/B test on it, where they're going to peel off, you know, some small amount of traffic and test it out. Now, this problem becomes more difficult for highly regulated industries and for companies whose model doesn't involve like Google scale, Facebook scale, where they just have like a billion users and they can just peel off 100,000 and it's not going to make a huge impact. When you're talking about, you know, you only have 50,000 customers a day using this thing. Not that that's a small number, but peeling off some of that traffic could be a little bit harder, but I still think that's the way to go going forward. This idea of testing things internally with your own data, that's certainly a huge part of this. And then secondarily going back and being able to break off, you know, some subsegment for doing some kind of A/B test of the model. Those frameworks I find are the ones that are lacking. I do not see a lot of that kind of ability, that nimbleness and that agility in a lot of companies. And that really comes down to like the heart of what everybody's talking about when they're trying to talk about a lot of the more product thinking these days, like more modern product thinking, as well as just being agile, this ability to like run an experiment and try it with some people, you know, be very clear about what's going on, but yeah, get some data back. Really, like, people talk a big game about data driven and being data driven in the enterprise, but when it comes down to it, like, it's not that they don't want to be, it's that it's really hard to do it, just exactly, given the way enterprises are set up.
And as a marketer, I can tell you that there's no way that I'm going to, you know, address my company or describe my company without saying that it's data driven, right? It's just something that we all have to say at this point, because we all know it's something that we all should be doing. Whether we can actually do it is another question. You have been an amazing guest. Do you have time for one more question? Can you stay until 5 minutes past the bottom? I want to ask about this other kind of structural change that technology may be enabling. And it's another one of those questions where business leaders have to think, do they change what's already existing or do they work with what they have now because they need it now? So I want to talk about the concept of offshoring and then maybe reshoring some of this work. Mm-hmm. So if you think about some of these processes that are beginning to be automated and intelligently automated, one of the ways those problems could have been addressed before is with, you get a big room with a lot of people and you just have them manually do that work. Whether that's actually offshore or somewhere else, somewhere, you know, in the country that you're in. But the idea is a lot of people do that. And if we think now about technology's ability to automate that work and maybe let those people do higher value activities or even reduce the need for some of that headcount overseas, how do business leaders think about this potential for technology to change their business, given that they need the results, of course, of what those people are doing right now?
Okay, I'm trying to think about the answer to that one. So I guess like, are you asking, is it like a cost
savings
thing?
I didn't ask it in a convoluted way.
Like, are you trying to say like, there's like, are you trying to ask about like the cost savings of it or like how you'll shift resources around or where we'll focus people? Like,
I guess I'm thinking, if you were to paint a dream scenario to a business leader, you could tell them, look, this process that you have 1,000 people overseas doing manually right now, you're going to be able to use automation and intelligent automation and AI to automate most of that process, bring that process back onshore in your own headquarters, and you're only going to need 10 people or 100 people to do it versus the 1,000 that you had overseas. That would be a dream scenario to paint for a lot of business leaders. Is that actually a plausible scenario, or is it more complicated than that? And should business leaders think about that in a more nuanced way?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably not the kind of decision that I'd be making as a head of AI. It seems like kind of like a CEO's kind of decision. But it does, I mean, it does come down to that to some extent. Like, I think we generally try to think about these things as human brains are a lot more powerful than any of these machine learning techniques that we have today. Like, even though these machine learning techniques have really up-leveled what we can do and like, you know, really, really expanded the kinds of things we can automate. At the same time, they're still pretty narrowly focused, right? Like, we can narrowly decide whether a document is, let's say, you know, has looks suspicious or not, right? Or has some kind of suspicious, I'll leave it at that, some suspicious or not. Once you build that model that's fairly accurate or as accurate as a person or nearly as accurate as a person, you can have that very specific narrow model scale, like, you know, potentially infinitely, but like really, really to the point where you're like, you have a person who's, in order to scale and scale this decision with a person, you've got to hire more people. Now you can just, you know, scale out your cluster and have this decision being made hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of times a minute, right? Whereas people can do a lot more than make this one decision that you're having them make right now. So they can kind of see and make connections between the different things that they're looking at and see the full workflow. I think that's kind of where we're thinking that you'll be able to kind of, instead of focusing on like, we have to do this one task today, and this is the task that we're automating, what are the things you could be doing if you didn't have to tie up all these resources and all these people making those kind of decisions? What kinds of problems could you be solving? What kind of products could you be building if you had all these people and all that kind of capacity, as opposed to having them all tied up doing this kind of, you know, more menial task?
So I came in at the end of this interview with a convoluted curveball of a question, but I think you saved it. I think you saved the interview with a great answer. Paul Tupper, head of AI at WorkFusion, thanks so much for joining us today on Machine Meets World.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you so much, everybody, for watching and listening. Please like, rate, comment, subscribe to the show. Let the algorithms know you like us. I'm James Kotecki, and that is what happens when Machine Meets World.